I'm Christian Scheller. Welcome to my podcast, an enthusiastic ramble through whatever has taken my interest the past week or so. Expect technology, games, history, travel, geekery, and as always, much, much more. Welcome to another Chinchilla Squeaks with me, Christian Scheller. Now, I am in my new two-weekly cycle. This is an interview episode. This episode is going to be full of very different microphone inputs because I'm currently recording this intro from a hotel room in Paris before KubeCon on one microphone, and there's a building site behind me, as always, and now there's police cars, so fun times. This is always the fun of traveling. I have two interviews for you. One is featuring Ben James of Atlas. That was recorded in my studio, so that sounds pretty good. Very interesting interview. One of a couple of companies I've spoken to over the past few months and have released a few interviews of using generative AI for interestingly, they started out as using it for generating architectural designs, so 3D architectural designs, but then quickly realized that the gaming industry was far more lucrative, which makes sense, because also you can get away with slightly non-normal looking designs in games more than architecture, I suppose. Trying to build a building generated by AI that may not work in the real world will be a challenge. Building it in a game is kind of okay. Anyway. And my second interview is with Bodan from Gathers AI, another generative AI tool. So I'm bundling them together. And I mean, it's all most people are doing these days as well. So there we go. And theirs is around using generative AI for market research, gathering together research. Clever name, eh? And that one was recorded at Slash, but actually in the one booking I managed to get in their podcast room. So it actually sounds very, very good. It's very, very different from my normal setup. We both sound fantastic. So there's going to be a lot of different audio quality there. This is probably the worst part. Sorry. All right, then. All of that out the way. Before I get stuck into those interviews, here's a few words from sponsors.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Canva. Today I'm joined by Ben James from Atlas. And you are working on something I've seen a few companies pop up the past couple of months around this space. And I've actually interviewed a couple of you. So it's a good opportunity to compare. What is Atlas? What do you do?
Yeah, hopefully I can show you something slightly new today that you haven't seen in some of the others. So we are a 3D generative AI company. We've actually been around for a couple of years building in stealth, almost 3 years now, building our own 2D to 3D AI technology stack. We got our first funding about 2.5 years ago from the European Union to build out AI tech in accordance with high-level guidance around trustworthy AI principles. And so that's really over the last few years what we've been building out. We started particularly with architecture, but we've expanded our offering basically to, you know, all of the different world building assets. So that's architecture, landscapes, props, the nature assets in between.
Why? What would someone be using this for? I mean, I look at some of the sort of material in your website and other press releases and things, and it all looks quite fantastical sort of models, but I would imagine that's not necessarily probably where your prime customer base is going to be. So what are people going to use something like Atlas for to generate? I think firstly, for what use case? And then secondly, what kind of data format do they actually get out at the end of this?
Yeah, so the use case is really around gaming. And especially we find that instances in which you need to deal with large amounts of scale or scope of assets is a good fit for us. So think open world games, for example. Think constantly updating maps or environments or things, even maybe those are two examples of a large amount of scale, but you can also have a large amount of scope. So user-generated content applications where you want to allow the user to look through hundreds or thousands of options as they as they create the worlds or add to the worlds of existing IP. So those are pretty stereotypical use cases for us. And I think, you know, the logic behind our system is we are not so focused on one-to-one replication. So we are not, we have built a tech stack that focuses on going from 2D to 3D, but that's not oriented around one-to-one replication of a single, you know, 2D image and reflecting that object in 3D space. Rather, we work as an input, we work on collections of reference images. So for example, the mood board or the concept art of a game development studio. And we run a series of machine vision scripts, for example, machine learning processes that try to extract from that image collection the underlying style, for lack of better words, the forms, the deformations, the local relationships, and the global assemblage of part to wholes, and then put that into a differentiable process by which one can generate actually the underlying meshes. So you asked about the output format. So those would be, you know, mesh models, so everything that you would expect from standard mesh formats, FBX, OBJ, US. But we can also integrate into pipelines. So we can also have this as a part of an Unreal Engine pipeline or a Unity pipeline or a Blender or Houdini pipeline.
Okay, so I think the interesting thing to unpack here is, I guess a lot of people are not completely aware of what a game development process looks like. And when we play these very large open world games, I guess there's an assumption that maybe a lot of it is auto-generated in some way, anyway, already, a bit of a mix. So, you know, if this is new, what's the current process that artists and developers would go through to generate all those models?
Yeah, there's two main approaches if you don't want to work with AI solutions like ours that you could take. So the most basic solution is a manual modeling approach.
Okay.
So this is, you know, think about, there are really great experts with this. And the benefit is you have full control over the creative process here. You choose the location of individual points, you connect those points with lines, you extrude those lines up into planes, and you give volume to those planes for boundary representations, for example. It's a very time-consuming process. It's a very inflexible process, but it does give you that control of being able to manipulate every vertex and have not only the style and the aesthetics in the form that you would like, but also from a performance perspective, the mesh topology, for example, or the UV mappings or the colliders done exactly to your game specifications. And that's the status quo, I would say. I think you would be pretty shocked, like I was, that the amount of times that is actually what is behind even these huge open world games that you think, how could a team of people spend so much time to create every single asset in this game? But that's why oftentimes these game development processes take such an enormously long time and are genuinely so expensive. We know from some of our work with the AAA game developers that they actually spend hundreds of millions of dollars on games that don't even go into production because of the amount of time and effort that has to be built there.
Yeah.
Now, there is an alternative to that. So an alternative to that is procedural generation. Yeah. So this is a tech stack largely comprised of something like conditional statements. So if-then statements. If I have a building above a certain height, then I would like it to be subdivided into X number of floors. Mm-hmm. So this is a good process and does automate certain aspects of the design. And so you have within that, you have parameters that can help you generate variants of design or pseudo-random instances of that design. But when we started building this a couple of years ago, this tech, I mean, that was really the goal to beat, right? So, you know, we thought, well, we need to be at least at the quality level that these procedural systems are. But the main issue that we saw in proceduralism, and my background is personally as a parametric architect, which is essentially procedural design within architecture. So where we saw limitation there is that they tend to not be as creatively diverse as an AI system. And that's due basically to the underlying technology. These tech stacks of conditional statements are essentially fixed algorithms. And so as you write them, as you get more and more lines of code to if this, then this, if this, then this, and these conditional statements, you end up in a certain level of inflexibility. And so especially in a game development process where you have something like early 3D concepting and you want to be very creatively diverse and look at lots of interesting aesthetics and even evaluate how maybe your users would engage with that, then procedural technology is not really the best fit. I think in some ways, what procedural technology is good at is if you know exactly what you want, you can really dive down and you can make sure that every single one of those lines of code that you're writing is very directed at achieving that result. But the nature of that then is that you end up with a slightly inflexible system. And when you work within procedural technology, the other limitation is that that's not a skill set that everybody knows. So that's a specific skill set within gaming that is, you know, akin to coding, and you need to have a certain proficiency there in order to do that at a high level.
And so comparing it now to what something like Atlas has, what's the difference? Do I instead say, you know, as the player moves into this world, generate me 20 buildings that look like some kind of dystopian sci-fi nuclear fallout, et cetera, et cetera. And each time, well, let's come back to that in a second. But yeah, so what's the workflow for using your tool instead then? What do I do?
Right. So the alternative that Atlas provides is, you know, give those references, those aesthetic images of what you want your world to look like, that sci-fi dystopian world, and ask the AI to try to understand what are the stylistic themes that it can pull out of that. What is the relationship between form and deformation and materiality, between depth, between, you know, part to whole relationships? What can the AI, one, extract from those reference images? And then once it's learned that information, what can it generate? Yeah. So you can think about, in this case, the AI acts a little bit like a design partner, where the brain that it has been trained exclusively, the world it knows is exclusively the world of reference images that you gave it. And so you have a certain confidence that when the AI generates you a large open world game, it is generating in your style. Now, it will be very diverse and it can make everything from a skyscraper to a smaller house to a landscape, but it's doing it in accordance with, you know, the aesthetics that you have taught it essentially in the training process.
Yeah. So technically speaking, or maybe not technically speaking, maybe just conceptually speaking, is this effectively that in each time when you give your reference material, you're kind of training your own model for that game, for that world, et cetera, et cetera?
You're correct, both conceptually and technically. So cool. Exactly, and that's really the value proposition that we bring, is that when we work with a studio, you know, their IP enters a closed IP loop. Yeah. And so we would train a model for them based on their IP, their reference images, their concept images, their mood boards. And once they have that, that's their generator. That's their generator to help them augment their intuition, to extend their creative process, also to be more efficient in that same creative process. And I think, you know, there's what we find is that there's benefits both on the extension of the creativity side, but there are also so many parts of the generative design, or let's say the creation of 3D concept, 3D meshes, that artists are not very excited about. Yeah. UV mappings, the creation of collider meshes, and the AI is a brilliant tool for this. So it can build this as part of its generative process. And so one of the nice things then is you're able to be much more efficient and really focus on the elements of the design process that are more creative.
Okay. But coming back to the question I was about to ask, so does the system retain memory though? Because, you know, if you go to an area and the first time it's created, it looks like X, and then you come back to that area and it doesn't look the same anymore, that is also probably not quite what you want. So I'm assuming that once something has been generated, can you then say, oh, well, in this case, always keep it like that. Maybe in this other case, it could change a bit, this kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, although I think what you've described would be a very interesting gameplay, to be honest, that the AI does... The AI does work as you espouse. So, you know, when you generate something, the AI remembers all the steps to get to that generation. So it's been trained on a certain set of images. The way that it generates that model, it has this, you can think of the AI as having this basically near infinite solution space, or a latent vector space in a more technical language. And it knows the path by which it got to the individual design. And so there's actually quite a lot of hierarchy and structure to that solution space. It knows what are similar designs, so ones that sit within a similar area of the solution space, in case you would like a district to look you know, very, very stylistically similar versus maybe the other side of the map that you would really like to push a different extreme. And because the output of these of the AI models are meshes, you know, FBX files or you know, points and mappings, then you can expect that that model that you generated is always going to be there when you come back at another point in time. But the benefit is also, it's a non-destructive workflow. So similar to like layers in a Photoshop process, if you go back through and change something in the generative design process, you can expect that that would filter through into your higher level of detail or the iterations that you had made with the AI. And so you do expect that the design is still there as you intended it, but you at least retain the flexibility of updating it quickly based on, you know, your gameplay or the gameplay of the users.
And just want to clarify something, because you've mentioned it and then I sort of browse around your website and I get slightly different images. So I just want to double check. So what you generate is just meshes. The detail on top is then added elsewhere or both?
No, we generate the detail as well. Okay. Where we also generate textures, but I tend not to focus on it because the text stack that we've built up is really about this kind of 2D to 3D in the three-dimensional space. That's what I think really is something quite unique to what we've built. Okay. Whereas the generation of textures, we work on top state-of-the-art models in order to generate that.
Okay.
Or we just allow that functionality from the user.
Yeah. Okay. And obviously the whole space of generative AI has kind of appeared in the public eye very recently, but it's been building for a little while. And you mentioned you've been in stealth for 3 years. So let's start with the foundation question is, what made you want to start working on this 3 years ago?
Well, 3 years ago, I was working at the intersection of design and tech as an architect. And in particular, I was doing a lot of work with machine vision and augmented reality. And I thought maybe there is an interesting connection between machine vision and machine learning, especially as it relates to architecture. Because if you think of a plan or a section or an elevation, which is a two-dimensional architecture drawing, that is essentially a document embedded with three-dimensional information. That's something given to a construction worker or a construction company to visualize and build out in 3D. And so I thought maybe there is an interesting way to connect some of the work that I had been doing with. I'm a self-taught coder of about 15 years, and I was able to get a small prototype up and running. And that was enough to apply for and receive funding from the European Union that was based around building out trustworthy AI systems. And so since then, the team has grown significantly with people that are much more clever than I am on the technical side of things. And we're very heavy now in the sort of machine learning and technical artists, with a big emphasis on the technical artists on our team. But that was really the initial motivation, was thinking, you know, could AI act as a design partner here in a way that, you know, oftentimes in the design process, you have very, very creative ideas, but you have a somewhat limited either time constraints or even just kind of capacity to visualize and to see all of those ideas. And so that's what the AI is particularly good at. I think another maybe interesting thing then is, because we started so early, this was before ChatGPT or Midjourney, so we weren't looking at a multi-view diffusion approach. So we were really looking at procedural tooling as the process to beat when generating massive amounts of worlds at scale. So we put a tremendous emphasis in building our AI on the editability of models, on the ability to integrate into existing pipelines. You know, we really saw a very clear problem in the industry there, that I think one of the interesting things for us watching the public embrace and the boom of generative AI has been amazing. And some of the underlying technology that has been built around it has been wild to see how well it performs. But I think what we see in the 3D AI space, to some extent, is that, you know, this is very interesting technology that has not yet found a good suitable fit within at least the gaming industry. And I think, you know, for us, one of the benefits there is just that we were building it so early with a different focus in mind before we would have had access to all of this kind of interesting creative thinking around new forms of generative AI.
But has this, you know, the problem when something you've been working on for a while suddenly becomes the hype cycle, you probably get a lot of people like VCs and customers suddenly asking for things that maybe they don't fully understand. Has it caused you to have to actually change a little bit what you were doing, or is it sort of so misunderstood that you can kind of just like, Oh, yes,
you,
we do.
You're absolutely right. I think, you know, this space is incredibly noisy. I think what's been interesting for us is when we pitch a game developer, when we give them a demo, when we show them generated assets, it tends to be a fairly straightforward conversation because they're looking at certain performance and aesthetic criteria that we have built our tech around. When we talk to a VC, it is a completely different game because you really have to kind of ground someone in the thinking of, you know, there are so many factors that make an asset for a game either a good fit or a bad fit. And it's, you know, it's about the performance of that asset. It's about the editability of that asset. It's about the ability to integrate into workflows of that asset. It's not just about the final aesthetics. Yeah. That's, of course, a very, very important piece. If you can't hit the aesthetic targets, no game is going to want to use you. But even if you can hit aesthetic targets, there are a lot of other factors to consider. And so, you know, I know this space is very noisy. We did just announce our fundraising round. Yeah. So we did raise during a very noisy market there. But I'm also very pleased to be out of the market now.
Yeah, well, it's noisy, but it's also a hard time. So so it's not terrible. And the market for the tools in this sort of game creation space, so you mentioned Unity and Unreal, Blender, I guess also Cinema 4D, some others. I mean, those are the main ones I know. But it's not the most competitive of spaces, especially for 3D commercial engines. There's a lot of sort of smaller scale game engines too.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you have those two very large gorillas in the room, are you ever worried that they are going to, if they haven't already created their own alternative for this? Oh.
It's always a risk. I think the risk from some of the large gorillas in the room is maybe not as big as you know, large teams trying to create it in-house. Actually, I think that's probably where, to some extent, we see a higher degree of risk. I think with, you know, Unity and Epic, they have such a clear offering that extends beyond content creation, you know, into the publishing and into the gameplay aspects that, you know, for us, you know, we have opportunity to partner with them rather than sort of for them to see us as a direct competitor at this stage. Now, I think, you know, longer term, we obviously have ambition to grow that as a platform and to consider that a platform like ours that's built on a new type of technology around generative AI that probably has arguably a transformative customer experience compared to what some of the existing solutions offer. I think that's a very powerful future potential that we have. But in the short term, what everyone needs are tools and platforms that integrate, that work with their existing, you know, skill sets, pipelines, and you know, tools as complementary tools like the Unities and the Unreals.
Yeah. So we can't have a conversation about generative AI without talking about hallucination and copyright. I think hallucination is probably one that's less of a concern for you, because you're imagining things anyway, so it doesn't have to be true. It's fine. But the copyright one is probably more concerning because people are likely to, you know, I would like it to look like Blade Runner, and then it suddenly looks a bit too much like Blade Runner, this kind of thing. So how do you cope with that?
I think there's two aspects of it. Well, maybe three. The first one, which is fundamental to us, which is a very nice benefit to us, is that when we built our tech stack, having that high-level guidance from the European Union, which has seven key principles of building out trustworthy AI systems, was particularly interesting. Yeah, I mean, it really helps ground us. It means that we have a tremendous amount of transparency into where our data came from. We have, you know, put in place certain diversity and inclusion standards for how we source that data. And it means that we put human agency and oversight kind of core and central to the process. That's one point. But I think the other that's pretty interesting, our approach is, again, probably in part because we started building before a lot of these state-of-the-art models came out, we have a much more mathematical approach to this. So the way that our AI works is we almost try to distill what are the underlying mathematical functions that would rebuild types of form from that collection of reference images. So we don't need a collection of 10 million 3D models that we got from the internet somewhere where we would have some risk of replicating parts of those 3D models. It's a more kind of agnostic, formal agnostic approach. The pro or con of that is that when we train an AI model for a specific customer, it takes longer. You know, it takes longer time to train that model.
You're breaking down the component parts as opposed to the whole.
Exactly.
Yeah,
but the benefit is, you know, like your Blade Runner example, if we worked with Blade Runner and they gave us reference images of Blade Runner, the AI would be able to create very interesting, immersive Blade Runner worlds. But if the AI didn't learn on the IP of Blade Runner, it's not going to be able to create those Blade Runner worlds, if that makes sense. So there's, you know, it's learning. It's really an output of what it has been trained on. And so on our side, the importance is to make sure that people are owners of the IP that they put into our system. You know, that if we work with a game developer, that they are legitimately using their own IP, because the, you know, otherwise we would risk that the AI was trained on IP that it shouldn't have been trained on.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. I guess that limits people a little, but it also causes less problems in the long run. So
it's up and down.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned your background was in architecture. I was actually interested to know, how applicable is this technology to at least, shall we say, more normal grounded architecture? I mean, you could have, you know, sort of highfalutin forward thinking architecture. It is probably more like a game, but, you know, the normal common day architecture, is something like this useful to architects or not really?
When we started, this was seen as an AI solution that was going to be deployed within the built architecture industry. As part of our early approach to the market, we talked to different stakeholders that we thought could be interesting. So VFX artists, urban planners, architects, and game developers. And one game developer that always stands out to me, he told me that he builds more architecture in a single game than an office does in 10 years, and he has no training as an architect. And so that was a little bit of a signal that even, you know, if you're generating architecture, there is a much larger pull and demand coming from the gaming industry than there is from the built architecture industry. That said, you know, there are very interesting use cases. When we started early on training our models aimed at built architecture, you can add loss functions to the AI. Loss functions just being the goals it is trying to achieve as it deals with balancing the different aesthetic constraints. So you can add loss functions to the AI built around natural ventilation or solar radiation capture to try to generate more environmentally sustainable buildings. You could do the same with structural constraints. Yeah. Now, in a gameplay setting, that tends to manifest itself through a different form. You might do lines of sight to encourage close combat shooting in a game as part of your narrative design. But I think the underlying technology is quite flexible here and could have potential future use cases there, although our focus is very much on gaming at the moment.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, yeah, interesting. And I kind of get the impression from the way you've described the process, but also the website, this is not something that anyone can really just experiment with. They have to talk to you. And this is something that's come up with a lot of the model, the very specific model-based companies I've spoken to recently, is it's very hard for people to have like a self-serve option, because there's a lot of pre-work that you do beforehand to make it useful, I think.
Yeah. We are trying to fix that. In January, we are going to launch a public platform version of this.
Oh, okay.
So we will do with alpha testing. We will start in January with this.
Okay.
But it is, as you note, because, you know, our process is we train a model that's specific for a game. So we are not a Midjourney or Stable Diffusion where anybody can just come and write that and see it. You know, we basically work within closed IP loops. We work with the data from a game developer. We generate something that's really their AI and then help them run it and make sure that it's optimized in the right way for the way they'd like to deploy that. But nevertheless, like, our thinking is that this is, you know, this is great tech. And especially if we can put it into a platform so small and medium and indie game developers can access that, I think that would be very interesting. You know, one of the kind of interesting learnings that's come out of this. So we've done some postmortems with games that we've worked with. And I think on average, we find we're about 200 times faster. Yeah. If we go through the whole process of generating a large world, that involves the training time, the iteration, and the generation. But there's two ways to look at that. So if you're a larger studio, of course, you see the efficiency gains that you can get there. But when we talk to a smaller, medium-sized studio, what's interesting is you could make a map that's 200 times larger, you know, or you could facilitate aspects of gameplay that would be otherwise impossible for your small team. And I think that's the other side of that, you know, benefit of having a creative design partner that is generative in nature.
It's one of those promises of a lot of these tools. And I feel like a lot of them don't live up to it. Now you can do more.
Yeah.
And a lot of people just are actually more living in concern that that means they won't do anything. But some of the better ones I've encountered, like for me, the one that's been massively helpful is some of the text-based editing and generating in things like Premiere, Adobe Premiere and Descript, where it really saves me so much time just deleting and removing and editing all the stops, the pauses, the ums, the ahs. I can actually spend more time on making the rest of the video better.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think a lot of the mainstream general purpose tools we've seen are really just people just generating stuff they never really needed in the first place. So whereas
I think that's right. But the other thing that's worth noting is this is such an early stage for this industry.
Yeah.
You know, the example that I heard recently that I really like is, I don't know if you know what the first television programs were, but they were just filming people reading the radio. And it was the first thought that somebody had for how we can use this new technology was to simply show the existing technology. And I think as more people adopt it, you know, as more interesting games start to think outside the box here, you'll realize that worlds can change as a player moves. You know, you can enable an entirely new kind of creative aspect of the economy, of the gameplay, where, you know, creation is part of what drives that gameplay. And so I think that's what's really exciting about some of the AI solutions.
Yeah, no, for sure. And on the subject of the future, shall we say, are there any titles that you can mention and that people might know that have so far used Atlas? Or at the very least, are there some available? Or, you know, knowing the development cycles of many AAA games, it could be they're not released yet.
They are not released yet. And in most cases, I'm not so able to talk about them. But I will say that soon we will be able to announce a couple of the bigger ones that people will be able to play. So that will be very exciting.
Okay, cool. And then, so with something that's so sort of closed loop as Atlas, I know it's possibly hard to say exactly, but if we were to speak in 6 months, 12 months, what's on your roadmap that you're working on that sort of next features? You've mentioned the public self-serve platform, but is there anything else?
That's the big one for us. You know, I mean, I think we will continue to work with some, you know, kind of giants in the industry, and we're really excited by that. You know, I think we're really excited by working with people that are at the cusp of doing very high quality games, very innovative and creative games. Yeah. But I think the other side of this is, can we open this up to more of a self-serve platform? Can we make this scale up so that we can really access, open up and allow more people to access the technology? And that's our big roadmap. And you know, all of the features that we are building out and all of the user experience is oriented around trying to make that as successful as possible.
Yeah. No, it's something that would be very interesting, because someone like me, who's a bit of a dabbler in trying to make games, I've always stumbled at the 3D model bit because I just don't even know where to start.
Yeah.
And it's similar with even things like Midjourney. If I just want a dumb thumbnail for my podcast, which is what I tend to use it for, I could get an artist or do it myself, but I'm releasing an episode a week. Yeah. It's not really the time. And it's the same when I want to make a game prototype. I have a great idea, and then I go to Blender or something, and then the idea's just gone because I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. So the ability to just have something that looks vaguely like I want that I could throw in and then start doing something with is quite appealing.
Yeah, so. I'm looking for it. Then I'll send you the link to the alpha testing program, and you can.
No, please do. I actually have a game idea I'm trying to work on at the moment. So
brilliant.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, and good luck. And I look forward to hearing, seeing, and playing what Atlas has been used with. So
thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much. A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, Gathers.
Yeah.
What is Gathers?
Gathers is AI market researcher for product and marketing teams that shrinks down the time to perform like elaborative 30, 40 pages report into 30 minutes of answering like simple questions and getting the high quality result. And like what differs us is we do not hallucinate. That's like
a confident statement.
Yeah. And I know that that's the confident statement, and we worked really hard in order for me to say that confident.
Okay.
So what are people doing with this? Is this for product ideas, for market, I mean, market research? You just said that, but market research for what?
So like our first use case is competitor research. Okay. So many companies or startups, they validate their ideas. They need to know like what is the state of other products. Mm-hmm. Or maybe in the companies like up to 200 people, they want to check competitors, what they are doing, how they can better position themselves in their market. And yeah, that's like the first use cases that we do.
And what started you down this journey? How long ago did you start and why?
We started off 1 year ago. We founded this company. We already did two pivots and it's a great startup.
What were the first two?
So we started off as an upskilling platform for AI ML engineers.
Okay.
And then we switched into optimizing processes for companies for non-technical departments. And that was at the same time with the rise of all of the hype generative AI. Yeah. And during that time, we gathered so many insights that like it was the obvious no-brainer to transform them into the product that our existing customers love and need.
Okay. And why did you start down this AI ML journey? I mean, you said a year ago. It's a very short period of time in the history of AI ML, but it's a long time in the history of the buzz around it. Is it something you've always been interested in, or is it quite recent?
So me myself, I'm Chief AI Officer of Gathers, and I've been developing AI solutions for the last 8 years.
Okay.
And what I loved about AI, what made me switch into that industry, is impact. Mm-hmm. Because AI is universal, like Andrew Ng said, it's like electricity. Mm-hmm. So whichever industry you choose, you can improve it, you can optimize it with AI technology. Mm-hmm. And that's what made me live to make an impact in this world. And while doing AI, that's the best way to make the brighter, better future.
All right.
Yeah, sorry for switching into philosophy.
So in this brighter future, what are customers that you can talk about doing with Gathers? What are they? I'm guessing the name is because they are gathering information, but what are they doing at the moment? How are they optimizing their research? Mm-hmm. How are they saving time? How are they saving money? Mm-hmm. Et cetera, et cetera. What are some of the stories you're hearing?
Mm-hmm. So imagine the future. Mm-hmm. Like you come to your office, you press on button and say, okay, please perform this research. Mm-hmm. And your AI co-pilot, your virtual AI market researcher, does all the job. All you need to do is just sip the coffee and validate. Say, okay, I like it, or please change this minor detail. Mm-hmm. So in that way, we first create high quality result faster. And second, we as people, we do not do boring work. We do not do something that's long, that's tedious. We just from minimum input get maximum result. And that's the life that I want for all of our customers.
You're very philosophical. I'm going to dent away at this a little bit. So firstly, we'll come back to the whole hallucination or not thing in a minute. But the first one there is, you say this is mostly competitor research, but a lot of competitors don't put their information in the public. Mm-hmm. So if someone asks for research about competitors, but there is no information to base it on, what do you do?
So for now, we just get as much information as we can. Mm-hmm. There are two sources of it. First is deep web search. Mm-hmm. The second one is we have an access to all of the paid resources Crunchbase, SimilarWeb, SEMrush, etc. And our customers, especially like small, mid-sized companies, they don't have to pay those $50,000 to access that information. They can get the reports based on that from us.
Yeah. Do those companies mind you doing that?
As long as they like the final results. So
I mean the Crunchbase and things like that.
We use official API.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I wasn't aware they had API. I mean, it's not something I've ever looked into, but mm-hmm. I wasn't aware they had any. Okay. And how are you so confident it's not hallucinating? How much double checking did you have to do before you could make that statement?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So before that, me myself, I was helping optimize non-technical processes for many companies. And I've gathered the combination of maybe 12, 15 insights mm-hmm. to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, you can take basic ingredients, but put the Michelin level star chef and he or she will make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So as some examples of those techniques, first, we know how LLM works.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the lost in the middle problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's when especially big LLMs, they do not retrieve facts from the middle of the document as well as from the start or the end.
Mm-hmm.
So first thing is, even when you use big models, you should not put more than 30% of the, you should not use more than 30% of the memory.
Mm-hmm.
One thing. Another thing, let me mention one prompting technique. It's called Let's Think Step by Step. And I'm sure like many people know about that. We people, before providing the answer, need to have the place to write the creep. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when you're in university mm-hmm. and you want to cheat. If you have this small piece of paper with concentrated information, that will help you get the right result.
Mm-hmm.
And while building the system, we on many levels allow LLM to generate some pre-knowledge before providing answer
mm-hmm.
that final user won't even see, but that will increase the accuracy. Third thing is like obvious, allow LLM to say no.
Mm-hmm.
If you do not know what to answer, like specifically, you must put instruction, do not answer.
Mm-hmm.
First thing that we are moving against the trend of using what's called vector databases.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's basically, yeah. So because many problems, even LLM can be great at reasoning, but as long as you, if you retrieve the wrong information to base your answer on, mm-hmm. it's going to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So we built this system to be really atomic. It's really complicated, like backend consisting of more than 20 different parts. Each is specialized in doing one narrow thing, but perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And they interact with each other. And it's like this combination of different tricks allow us to create reports that are not hallucinated. And to prove that, under each like block of text, we provide 5-6 exact citations yeah. from yeah. sources that were used to generate that.
Yeah. And so to get people through this process who are not completely used to this concept of prompt engineering or whatever you want to call it, do you take them through that process and say, oh, that needs a bit more information, try this? Or is it like a kind of wizard type step? You know, how do you get people to provide the right input to give the output?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of the prompting techniques, they inserted on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
So for user, it's all about simple interaction.
Okay.
And it's more about, so we made sure that we ask user for a simple feedback. User does not have to ask it for us. It's basically like Tinder-like experience. User just gets information, says like, yeah. dislike, I want to change something. If it's okay, we move to the next stage.
But just when it comes to liking and not liking, I mean, if you're doing market research, you will possibly get answers you don't like. I mean, what's the context of the like and the don't like?
It's maybe that's yeah. user-specific, for example. Yeah. If they already performed research, for example, at one stage, we propose the list of competitors.
Yeah.
If user says, okay, I already done the research on that one, please do not include it in.
Okay.
But about the like or dislike of the final result, there are no like standards of how to perform market competitor yeah. research. But in our team, there is like product guy who has personally created over 500 reports.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got all of the best practices of what to look for, in what structure to provide the final answer.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And we coded that as like proposals.
Mm-hmm.
So you can change everything, but the best practices are already provided. And mm-hmm. if you agree, just go on and get the result.
I think I was more just thinking, you know, sometimes you do market research and it might be that this is a dumb idea.
Then, sorry, LLM, we'll be honest with you. Yeah,
yeah, okay, good. Well, that's good because I often meet a lot of businesses where you think, did you do any research? Does anybody actually need this? I don't know. You know, sometimes where we live, you'll see like three cafes open next to each other and you think,
why?
Did you do any research? Do you need that many cafes in one place? Anyway. Okay. Mm-hmm. And if you're allowed to mention it, has anyone launched new projects, products, etc., based on using Gathers yet?
It's like our competitor research or...
No. I mean, they've used Gathers and it gave them information and then they've done something with it and launched something. I mean, in a year, maybe not, but have they?
Like one of our early adopters, they are VC firms. Mm-hmm. So they heavily used that to make decisions for the companies that wants to get investments.
And it's only been a year and you're already in the slush...
100,
hot 100. I don't think that's not necessarily in this weather. So, in such a short space of time, how do you think that happened? What are you doing that has pushed you above so many other companies so quickly?
I guess it's about the team. Mm-hmm. So we paid huge attention to gather like rock stars at each department when to create this 1+1=11 magic. Mm-hmm. And if everyone likes what he or she does, if everyone is great at what they do, this creates this ability to grow. Mm-hmm. And to add an extra point, this is the startup that started during the war in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So it's like accept everything. Imagine this picture of the floor and the flower that pushing through. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's what made us stronger and that's what made us maybe... I don't know. I'd like to say that stronger than some of our competitors.
I sort of get what you mean, and let's come to, I think I first encountered you when I was at IT Arena in Lviv, but now we've come, I don't know, 2-3 months later, and we're not that far away, I suppose. But anyway, it's a few months later. I'll ask some of the same questions I ask people there, even though it's a little bit odd to ask them in Finland. But
that's
anyway,
just your thing.
Just to tie it together. I heard from a few people there saying that strangely, and it's a horrible kind of reason, that the brand of Ukraine has become almost stronger in the past 2 years, which is unfortunate, but you know, a lot of those negative connotations that people used to have, they've put them aside now, that the country has really kind of proven proven itself above people's assumptions. Have you found, I don't know what kind of companies or products you were pitching before, but have you found it, I mean, I'd say easier because you're still in a conflict zone, but easier in terms of people have more time to hear from you being from Ukraine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it works on the both sides. It certainly is easier. But from my perspective, we've been great as an IT tech nation, the last 10-15 years. But we were mostly like outsource companies. Exactly. I do love that people get to see how we shine now and how we've been shining before.
Do you think like, I don't know, I feel like I asked this question at IT Arena a few years ago, but let's ask it again. Do you think that knowledge that a lot of people built from in outsourcing work has really helped? You know, you spent several years just doing work for other people and it may not have been the most interesting thing, but you gathered a lot of knowledge from bigger companies that came before you and now you can leverage that knowledge and experience.
Like what I see, we become really strong from tech perspective. But when it comes to building products, it's kind of different thing. So there is this disbalance that I... So, for example, during like checking our competitors at Slush, we are stronger in technical perspective, but we can be weaker in terms of how to present our project, how to make it look attractive, etc. While many projects in other regions, they are really great at selling. They are really great at packaging. But when it comes to delivery, I see this maybe my subjective trend.
I don't think I agree with you anymore. Strangely, this was a topic of conversation at IT Arena in maybe 2018 or something. And I think it was true. But I'd actually say now, I think a lot of Ukrainian companies, I would argue, are actually better.
Yeah, we are getting. Yeah, yeah.
especially here, kind of in the Nordics, where they're a little more reserved, mm-hmm. and a lot of Ukrainian founders are not reserved at all. Mm-hmm. I feel like Ukraine kind of has pushed more into the sort of American style of delivery, mm-hmm. which we can talk about whether that's good or bad.
Yeah, but
it does actually make you more outspoken in a good way. Well, whatever, than some other European countries who have kind of not had to work at it as much for a mm-hmm. few years. I'd actually argue you've got better, I think, in the past years.
Yeah, I can agree. Even remember at the start of our podcast, like when I confidently said, we do not hallucinate, kind of bold statement.
It's true, yes.
Yeah. But we are working really hard on technical perspective, not to be bullshitters who,
Okay, you personally, where have you picked up that confidence of delivery from?
It's from working hard. It's like I like being confident at what I created. And yeah, that's the thing that gives me confidence. I don't like confidence for the sake of being confident, like fake it till you make it. Mm-hmm. So I do like performing hard, doing homework, making something work. And when we do, like, there is no point of being shy, of being like calm. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
And if a customer comes to you and says, you said it doesn't hallucinate or lie, it has, how will you take that?
Well, luckily, that's never happened before. But when they do, it's not something that, like, because we went so far to achieve this level of accuracy, I think it would just need to create some tweak for some use case. So it's about polishing, not reinventing the engine.
How much work is it for you to tweak that engine each time? I'm assuming you're creating your own models based on what you've said. So how much effort is it to rework it each time? Or are you doing it pretty regularly all the time?
Yeah, so we are not training our own models.
Okay.
So due to our unit economy, we solve really big problem. When you outsource creating such report, it costs like $5,000. Mm-hmm. When you have your analysts in-house, they spend time worth like $200, $300. Mm-hmm. So we can charge per one report like $150. And that allows us this high marginality to use best models like from Cloud, from GPT-4. When one report like costs us to produce from $6 to $9, but it's okay because it's really lucrative, because we can sell it for much higher price. Mm. So that's why we rely on the best. We are not like customer support that when you do AI customer support functionality, mm-hmm. Your economy, it wouldn't work. And so due to that, our tweak is not fine-tuning model, is not working with the data, etc., which is long, expensive.
Kind of the filter of it.
Yeah. It's more on like infrastructure level, more on prompt level, and more on the backend level, mm-hmm. honestly. Yeah.
Well, the middle end, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Middle end. So it's only been a year. If we're back at Slush next year.
Mm-hmm.
You've won the Slush 100. I think that's a thing. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. What are you going to be working on in the next year?
On the next year, we will be covering many niche use cases because there is difference how to perform market research for gaming industry or for any other industry. And we have many experts that know how to do that. We will digitalize the way they perform their mm-hmm. research so anyone can get like high quality expert-led pipeline. And in that way we'll be scaling to, I want to cover all of the markets, but I know that it's not going to be possible for the startup at the beginning, so to cover as many as possible.
Also, you don't cover all markets at the moment?
For now, we are kind of general AI market researcher. Okay. Yeah, but to achieve quality,
you want to drill into
different industries.
Okay. So what's the first ones you want to tackle?
Currently, we are really investigating, so we are really picky to to choose the best industry that, yeah, you know, that will provide the best value.
Okay, cool. I think we're good.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was really great.
And those were my interviews with Ben and Bodan from Atlas and Gathers, respectively. All right, then. What's news from me? Well, I've been traveling and I actually was off last week, so not a tremendous amount. Nothing much has really changed since the news episode last week, apart from being at KubeCon with the building site behind me, which is even louder as I'm recording this part. So there we go. I've been working on a tech writing book, actually, for Pact Publishing, and that is... my God, it is finished. I'm not completely sure when it's being released, but if you're keen to take a read of that and basically read a little bit of a summary of the past 10 years of my existence, although it's not an autobiography, it is a practical advice book, then head on over to Pact Publishing to take a look. And I'm already starting work on some new books too. So that's the main thing from me at the moment, I think. As always, if you want to find out more about me, you can head over to christianschiller.com. Take care, everybody. Thank you very much for joining me, and see you next time. I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at christianschiller.com, where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions and helping me produce my shows and work.
Spread the word. When you get a fresh hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Jake from State Farm here, hanging out with Mel's Mow and Grow. Mel chose State Farm for small business insurance because his local agent is a small business owner too. So she knew how to help him personalize his policies. And now, he's rolling in the green. Like a good neighbor. Guys, I'm trying to do the line.
Oh, sorry, Jake.
It's all good. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to an agent today.